I'm going to talk about heraldry. And you know anything about heraldry? Now, I talked a little bit about this the other year or so. But I keep looking for all the various things that identify these lost tribes. Now, the lost tribes fascinate me. They just fascinate the living daylights out of me. Where did they go? The tribes, that is. Now, if what some Bible teachers say is true, and if Leviticus 26 means what it says, and I'm sure of the second than I am of the first, so you got to listen to the first sentence. God will punish his people seven times. And if those times mean a year, and days translate to years, a day for a year, there is a lot, both deductive and inductive, of evidence, both from the way God's treated his people and what you can deduce from God's word, that make me take a second look at that principle of 25-20, seven times 360 years, as God's statement of punishment on his people if they disobeyed him when they went into the promised land. You follow it, those times bring you to the end of the 1700s and the beginning of the 1800s. I don't know why that there was such a breakout in the 1800s. Not only do we find Schliemann digging up Troy and the Rosetta Stone, and the breaking of the hieroglyphics. Schliemann didn't dig up the Rosetta Stone. We know who did. But the Rosetta Stone was broken, opening the mysteries of Egypt and hieroglyphics, and then Behistun, analyzed by Professor Rawlinson, and Lawyard and Botta digging at Nineveh and uncovering the great libraries. And suddenly we discover what the lost tribes were called on the other side, the enemy side, not the biblical side. And people that formerly could not be recognized, suddenly you have the name that lets you recognize them. The Persians called them Saki or Sakasuni, sons of Isaac. The Assyrians called them Beth Kumri, Kimri, or Sumerian. Scythian simply is a wanderer, from the Hebrew word for scoothes. Feast of the Tabernacles is the Feast of Scoothes, booths, temporary dwelling places. Same period of time, 1800s, between 1846 and 1862, on the shores of Lake Hallstatt in Austria, amid the mountain country of Salzkammergut, George Ramsayer, director of the Hallstatt State Mine, began to excavate the graves of a prehistoric cemetery where a flourishing community had buried their dead. Between 1846 and 1862, he uncovered no less than 980 bodies. I'm reading from The Celtic World by Barry Coonleith. In 1876, the Vienna Academy of Sciences began to excavate the nearby prehistoric salt mines, where bodies were so preserved that garments of the miners were still preserved. Meanwhile, in Switzerland, another important discovery was being made at Latin, on the banks of Lake Neuchatel, at the northeastern end where the river Thiel flowed into the lake, a lowering of the water level in 1858 revealed blackened timbers. At first, they thought people had just dumped things into the lake. They then discovered some flood had wiped out an entire city at Latin. 1846 to 1858, this strange lowering of the water level of the lake, and Celtic culture bursts on to the world. Same time span as these other remarkable dates that will exhaust the timing of the period of punishment promised on these lost tribes in their wanderings. Now, these digs at Hallstatt and Latin tear apart the usual breakdown by the Danish archaeologist that divided the prehistoric period of Europe into the Age of Stone, the Age of Bronze, and the Age of Iron. And suddenly the real roots of historic Europe, the Celts, breaks open, and the Hallstatt period is broken into A, B, C, and D. The Latin phase is broken into two separate phases, and then a third is added. So you have a sevenfold breakdown, but it all boils down to a simple truth. The Celts originated north of the Black Sea. At the earliest, the 8th century B.C., most will date them beginning into the 7th, heightening up in the 6th, into the 5th century B.C. You read 2nd Esdras, the 10 tribes disappear at the same time. And as they came back from Babylon, a remnant of the Judah kingdom, an invitation was given to the lost tribes that had settled on the eastern side of Assyria between the border, or on the border between Assyria and the Medes, south and east of the Black Sea and south and west of the Caspian Sea, between the Tigris River and the Caspian Sea. They refused to return to Palestine. Ezra says they took counsel among themselves and took a year and a half to pass through the headwaters of the Euphrates River, looking for a place where they could practice their own laws called Ar-Sareth, which means hill or city of Sareth. And they disappear. In the mid-1800s, Celtic treasures reveal these Celtic tribes that swept across northwest Europe appear. Nobody knows from where they came. At the same place the 10 tribes disappear, north of the Black Sea. One has said the burial ground of the 10 tribes is the birthplace of the Celts. Don't give me all this business about how a Jew is supposed to look. There is no such thing as a Jewish physical type. Esther was blonde and fair, and Sarah was blonde and fair, and David was ruddy. So those skull sizes and all those other things mean nothing. And how much blood, as someone says, the seed of faith, the bloodline of faith that can be traced through the seed of Abraham, how much is enough? Only God knows. Most of the sons of Jacob had a lot of other blood in them. But these lost tribes were not lost to God. And if the Celts were not the tribes, then where did the tribes go and how did the Celts get there, since one disappears in the same place where the other one arises and they're both a big mass of people? And how come we didn't hear about the collision? Why is it people don't want to accept this? They come in riding horses and carrying everything they have in wagons. Prior to them, you have the urnfield culture. They bury their dead, cremating them in urns. The Celts bury them, wagon, horse trappings, weapons, and all. And they're not dug up until the 1800s, when the time of persecution and punishment had run its course, and the beginning of the revelation of their heritage is allowable in God. Now, most people who preach are still drawing upon a stream of theological literature that flows out of the Middle Ages and out of German idealism that is so dated and passed on like saber-toothed tiger curriculum in seminaries. And it's a time to rethink the foundational truths. They won't change. But that which was in God's Word all along suddenly receives the support of archaeology. Now, I've been teaching on this subject for many ways. I'm interested. If these people that are the Celtic nations are not the lost tribes, then who are? Got to be a population group that big. Now look where they went. Come over here with your camera. Sweeping across Europe Look at all these Celtic tribes in this map. The emergence of the Celts. Try to get a straight down on it picture if you can, Peter. The hope. Your camera went off? What a day. I can't believe this day. Let me turn this way. I'm going to buy a Sony camera. What's that one? That's the Sony. I'm going to buy something else then. I thought Sony things never went out. Look at this. Try to get the whole thing, including the British Isles. We're not going to put you on camera while you fix that one, Joe. I never saw a day like this. I wonder how many... I wanted to put camera on me for a minute. I wonder how many television programs could survive what we've gone through today. Take the idiot cards away from some of those $600,000 a year newscasters. Now look at this. Try to zoom in enough till you can see the fine print. How many different tribes scattered all across this area? They came in wave after wave. You see, those Israelites were always good at producing a lot of kids. If their wife couldn't handle it, they'd find the handmaidens in the tent. That's the biblical Israelites. Isn't that the way they worked? I mean, you know, like old Jacob. He worked 7 years for Rachel. Got surprised by Leah. Well, I wonder who tricked him into bed with all those other Canaanite handmaidens. I mean, he produces a flock. And all 12 of those kids didn't come from Rachel and Leah. How many of you know that? Of course, I know all good Bible students believe the stork flies them in. Or you plant seeds in the lawn. You have spiritual children. That Jacob was an... Those Old Testament patriarchs. Boy, if I was a woman, I wouldn't want to marry one of the old goats. That, to me, the proof of the grace of God. How he put up with those reprobates, it gives me hope. But anyway, they produce a lot of kids. They really produce a lot of kids. And the first one got all the land, so the younger ones had to go find some new farms. And since they travel light, they just kept going in wave after wave. They all came right here and here and here. The very area where the lost tribes disappeared. Now, why don't we find a collision, since there were millions of them? And why is it the Celts appear where they disappeared? And nobody knew that until after the 1800s. Second, very important point. All these Celtic nations were conquered and driven back by the Romans or by the Huns, the Slavic nations that followed, except this small area, Wales and Ireland and England and Scotland, where the Celts were driven to a final outpost and are the purest remnant of the Celtic nations. And that's why we're interested in them, this northwestern Europe area. Now that leads me to heraldry. Heraldry, simply defined, I got a nice little definition of it here. And I'll see if I can find it in one simple sentence. Heraldry is as old as the human race. And the carrying of banners has been the habit of nations since the beginning of time. Heraldry symbolizes the nation's history or the family's history. It brings in symbol form. I'm still looking for this simple little definition of heraldry that is in this book, but I'm giving it to you while I'm looking for it. Heraldry is neither more nor less than the science and art of hereditary symbolism. Write that down. Heraldry is neither more nor less than the science and art of hereditary symbolism. symbolism of some form or another has always been in use among nations and tribes. But in Europe, in the Middle Ages, it became hereditary for individuals and institutions. But let me say it again, the one sentence. Heraldry is neither more nor less than the science and art of hereditary symbolism. Hereditary symbolism. And there's just something about it. An institution will not take the symbolism that is not hereditary and not to which it's entitled. Now, why is it that in the Celtic nations and in the northwestern European nations, let me read how many. If there were only one or two coincidences of the hereditary emblems that go back to biblical Israel and Judah, it might be a coincidence. But the fact is, to those that study heraldry, there are more than 30 of Israel's emblems in the heraldry of Britain and the United States alone. Why? Why didn't Russia pick up on this? Heraldry is hereditary symbolism, so it only goes back a little ways. How come they got a hammer and a sickle? I'll tell you, they didn't know it. They think they were smart. God's going to hammer the hell out of them and harvest them with a sickle of wrath and bring their own heraldry true. How come China's got so many dragons in it? Why do these heralds end up here? Why in the lost tribes, since they went over into the east, how come their heraldry didn't show up in Iran? They were settled on the borders of the Medes. Why is it that nobody pays attention to this? This fellow says it right. As we consider the strange omission of studying heraldry, one gets the feeling that some powerful force has long been discouraging and even obstructing this line of research, perhaps for fear we might find out who we are. In this field of heraldry, you find your most conclusive evidence of the Israelitish origin of the Celto-Saxon people. Now, if somebody's listening to me for the first time, I'm not one of these deep-end guys. I don't go off the deep end. I just refuse to throw the bathwater of fact out, or rather the baby of fact out with the bathwater of some people's wrong interpretation. Neither am I one of those identity people who tries to argue that the Jews that are returning to Israel are not truly Jews. I just recognize what God recognized even back in Egypt and said it to Ezekiel, that there were two groups, two sisters, Ephraim, Samaria, and Judah. Judah and Benjamin, the tribes, the kingdom to the south, only a remnant of which came back, rebuilt the second temple, and provide the seedbed from which the growth of world Jewry has come. And I believe they are Jews, descendants of Abraham, and I believe that they are instruments in God's prophetic plan, the restoration of Israel. I'm not anti-Jew, but I refuse to believe the lost tribes are lost. And I know what the Bible says they must be. They must be a gigantic nation, a commonwealth of nations, many kings, pushing people to the ends of the earth, controlling the gates of their enemies, and a population group that you can only compare to the sand of the sea and the stars of the heaven. And only the Chinese, the Russians, and the northwestern European nations qualify, with the United States being the offspring of those same Celtic people. Now, why is it people won't even look at this evidence? Though generally unrecognized, it is nevertheless an indisputable fact that the basic heraldic emblems of Britain, Ireland, the United States, Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Iceland, the Netherlands, and several related nations are identical with those of ancient Israel. Further, in the case of Britain and the United States, we have no herald emblems other than Israel's. With the single exception of the Welsh dragon, which was not the emblem of the ancient Britons, every national emblem of Britain and the United States is an Israel emblem. Everyone. It will be argued, of course, that these emblems were adopted from the Bible when the Celto-Saxon nations became Christian. Platypus spit. It has no basis in fact for the simple reason that these emblems were in use by Celto-Saxon ancestors both in Britain and on the continent for several hundred years before Christ ever came to the earth. And that can be documented. And as I've said, more than 30 of Israel's emblems are in the heraldry of Britain and the United States alone. That means not coincidence or chance. Must have a meaning. Furthermore, many of these emblems appear on the heraldry of widely separated sections of the Celto-Saxon people. One example is the use of the lion by all of them, except Iceland and the United States. They all use the lion. As the very purpose of heraldic emblems is to provide continuing evidence of family, tribal, and racial identity from generation to generation. By the way, folk tales do that too. I was going to tell you where Jack and the Beanstalk and Snow White and the Seven Dwarfs and Little Red Riding Hood and Hansel and Gretel and all those stories came from, wasn't I? I forgot. That's one I forgot. You can hold that one over me. I don't do you any good, though. It follows that the peoples and nations today whose emblems are, and for ages have been, the emblems of Israel, must be a continuation of that ancient people, or else somebody stole them. That's why that British atheist said, God's word is a lie, because the people that fulfill the promises for the lost tribes, Israel, are the British Empire. So they stole them. Now they stole their emblems. God's not big enough to hold their flags on. A flag's an emblem, a symbol. Very few people like to steal flags. Now, they marched with flags. I'm going to skip over all the business of breaking the tribes down. Simply stated, there were 12 sons of Jacob, and Joseph had two sons that Jacob adopted, and they were to receive Manasseh and Ephraim equal position with the other sons. That made 13 tribes. But Levi was given a priestly function not to own any land, and therefore they had the right to live in all the tribes, and they served priestly functions for the people. So there were 12 land-owning tribes still, though 13 Levi being set apart. Then the two sons of Joseph still rounded it out to 12. Each of these tribes marched through the wilderness under the leadership of Moses. And Numbers 2:2, which is where I told you to go, to those that think heraldry started in the Middle Ages, every man of the children of Israel shall pitch by his own standard with the ensign of their father's house. That means as the children of Israel would camp in the wilderness, marching across the wilderness area, they would camp in a definite plan. You got that thing working yet? Come over here, I want to show you something. If you can, come over here. Now, a standard was a rallying point for several tribes. There were four standards in the camp, and three tribes rallied around the standard. And usually the standard hung from a crossbar and was elevated, easy to see. Then each of the three tribes that gathered around the standard had their own ensign that normally was carried on a pole. Now, as they would camp, here's a picture. Now, I'm reading from, so they get proper credit. If I can find this, I'm going to put it in our bookstore. W.H. Bennett, Symbols of Our Celto-Saxon Heritage. As they camped in the wilderness, Dan was on the north, Judah on the east, Reuben on the south, Ephraim on the west. On either side of Dan were Asher and Naphtali, on either side of Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun, on either side of Reuben, Gad, and Simeon, on either side of Ephraim, his brother Manasseh, and the other son of Joseph, Benjamin. Or rather, the other son of Jacob, brother of Joseph, Benjamin. As they gathered, the standards of Dan, Reuben, Judah, and Ephraim would be elevated on a crossbar. Then Ephraim, Dan, Judah, and Reuben would have their own ensigns on a pole. So you would have the standard plus three of the ensigns that were heraldry. That's all it was. Standards. Heraldry. Now, if you want to know what their symbols were, you read the prophecies about each of the sons in Genesis 49 and Deuteronomy 33. And as the prophecies are given under inspiration of God by Jacob in Genesis 49, where he blessed the sons, and Deuteronomy 33, where Moses blessed the tribes, you have the basis for their heraldry. Let's take them one at a time. Reuben, not the standard at this point, but the tribe of Reuben. They had primary and secondary emblems. Reuben, Jacob's eldest son, was named Reuben. And in blessing him, Jacob said, "Reuben, thou art my firstborn, my might." This is Genesis 49, verses 3 to 4. "Thou art my firstborn, my might, and the beginning of my strength, the excellency of dignity, and the excellency of power. Unstable as water, thou shalt not excel. Because thou wentest up to thy father's bed, thou defilest thou it, he went up to my couch." And as this author says, in this description of Reuben, two points stand out. He was primarily a man, but weak morally. Further, his nature was changeable, so much so that Jacob declared him to be unstable as water. Thus, Reuben is pictured as a man, primary emblem, and as water, secondary emblem. The wavy lines or wavy bars symbolizing water. These then became the emblems of the family, and later the tribe descended from him. And you can trace through heraldry where the man and the water are carried in the heraldry emblems, hereditary to the race, the tribes, the institution. You have the remnants of Reuben. Simeon. Simeon and Levi are dealt with together in Jacob's blessings. For reasons I've already explained, that Levi is separated from Simeon and made to serve in the temple without property. The symbols and the description of Simeon and Levi are preempted by Simeon. And the description is clear. Simeon and Levi are brethren. Instruments of cruelty are in their habitations. In their anger they slew a man. You read in the margin of the Bible, it reads, "Their swords are weapons of violence." The record of their slaying of the man that is mentioned by Jacob in this blessing is in Genesis chapter 34, verses 25 to 26. "Simon and Levi took each man his sword and came upon the city boldly and slew all the males. And they slew Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword." The object mentioned later becomes the emblem of Simeon only. Now, there are many sources for this. I'm just skipping along from the Talmud, from Jewish historians of heraldry, to other sources. The primary emblem of Simeon became the sword. But also, in their violent actions, they attacked the city. And the city being a walled city with turret and gates, the secondary emblem of Simeon, who carried the sword, and to commemorate the capture of that fortified, turreted, and towered city where they slew all the men the gate, and the turreted gate, or tower gate, became the secondary emblem of Simeon. You can trace that sword and that gate in heraldry, and you have the hereditary remnants of Simeon. Judah. Judah was given promises so far beyond other tribes that they end up with four. They end up with four symbols. Jacob's blessing on his fourth son, Judah. Now, you don't have to remember the details if you can just get the emblems, because I'm going to show you something after we get the emblems laid down. You just got to remember that Reuben, man and water, wavy line. Simeon, sword and turreted gate. Judah. Judah, in verses 9 to 11 of Genesis 49, Judah is the lion's whelp. From the prey, my son, thou art gone up. He stooped down, he couched as a lion, and as an old lion, who shall rouse him up? I've got to turn this till you can pick it up on the camera right. Drop the phone number for a moment. I put numbers in my book here. Three lions are described. The lion's whelp, one that rises up from the prey, and an old lion couched down. Three lions. A lion's whelp to a lion, and also three lions. The next verse, he is, as you read on, in possession of a scepter and finally is associated with a grapevine. You read the blessing of Judah in Genesis 49, you end up with a lion, three lions, secondary, a scepter, never used in heraldry until David became the king over all of Israel, and grapevines. You have four emblems. Now let me race through the others so you know where we're going. You can take the emblems, the designations of the blessings given on these tribes by Jacob and Moses, and get your primary and secondary emblems. Dan, serpent by the way, and a horse whose heels have been bitten by the serpent. Many times they combine them with a horse and a serpent at the feet of the horse. Dan having the horse, because the statement of Jacob is, Dan shall be a serpent by the way, an adder in the path that biteth the horse's heel so that his rider shall fall backward. Naphtali has a short promise, a hind let loose, that later on turns in heraldry to a stag. Gad, a troop shall overcome him. They couldn't put a troop on the heraldry and on the shields, so it was the person leading the troop, holding the pennant aloft. Asher, you read the blessing, the dainties, his bread shall be fat and royal dainties. Covered cup or goblet became the emblem. Issachar, a burdened-down ass. I changed my name to belong to that tribe. Zebulun. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea, and he shall be for a haven of ships, and his border shall be unto Zidon. I want to show you something. I got a picture of it here. It'll interest you, I think. Zebulun. With this reaching across from the Sea of Galilee to that great Bay of Haifa, we have another tribe that could release ships into the Mediterranean. I just wanted to bring that up for later reference. Zebulun shall dwell at the haven of the sea. Zebulun's emblem became the ship. Joseph. Joseph got the blessing that's going to be divided among two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. His primary emblem, Joseph is a fruitful bough, even a fruitful bough by a well whose branches run over the wall. The archers have sorely grieved him. That came to be the emblem of Manasseh, the olive branch and the arrows. Because Manasseh becomes the emblem that runs over the wall and does its own thing, separated to become a great nation, though Ephraim is to be a commonwealth of nations. So with Manasseh goes the olive branch, emblem of the heraldry of Joseph, and with Manasseh goes the arrows, retained by Ephraim. His glory is like the firstlings of his bullock. His horns are like the horns of unicorns. With them he shall push the people together to the ends of the earth. They are the 10,000s of Ephraim, the thousands of Manasseh. The wild bull or wild ox, the horn of power, and the unicorn become the emblems of Ephraim. We come to Benjamin, the youngest son of Jacob. Benjamin shall raven as a wolf, and the wolf becomes the emblem of the tribe of Benjamin. You got them all? Now, those are the tribe symbols. Let me do it fast for you again. You just write them down, because you need to memorize this. Reuben, a man and wavy lines. I went very fast, but you can see the source, Genesis 49, Deuteronomy 33. A man and wavy lines. Simeon, a sword and a turreted gate. Judah, a couching single lion, three lions, scepter, a fruitful branch of grapes. Dan, snake, horse, sometimes with a snake at the feet of the horse. Naphtali, a racing hind, later changed to a stag. Gad, leader of a troop with the pennant flying. Asher, cup or goblet covered, carrying dainties. Issachar, the burdened down ass. Zebulun, ship. Manasseh, olive branch and arrows. Ephraim, horn, wild ox, unicorn. Benjamin, wolf. You got it? You'll find as those are added up, there's 12 and 12. 12 primary and 12 secondary all total, but that's just rather interesting. At least 19 of the total are still retained by Celtic nations. Now, when Jacob gave his promise, he said, "Gather yourself together that I may tell you that which shall befall you in the last days." Last days. These are the last days. Now, those were the ensigns of the tribes. That's what each tribe, as three of them would gather on each of the four sides, would have on their flagpole. In addition, the three tribes were together around four standards. Got that? You want me to show you again? I expect you to study now. We had fun long enough. Judah carried the standard on the east, Dan on the north, Ephraim on the west, Reuben on the south. Judah had its tribal ensign. Each of the three had their ensign on the pole. But they all three gathered to a standard, which was carried on a crossbeam, and the center stage tribe, Judah, Dan, Ephraim, and Reuben, carried the standard also. So they would carry, it's like someone who carries the flag of the United States and the flag of California at the same time. The standard would be the equivalent of the United States flag, the ensign, the state flag. Reuben carried the standard on the south side. Now, I can make the standards very simple for you. The standard in each and every case was the same as the tribal. The standard of Judah, the standard of Judah was the lion. The standard of Reuben was the man. The standard of Ephraim was the wild ox. And the standard is traced to the vision of Ezekiel, where he saw those seraphims, the ox, the man, the lion. Only Dan changes from the serpent and the horse, which was the tribal ensign to the standard of an eagle. Dan changes to the standard of an eagle. And because the ox and the golden calf of Baal begin to be so worshipped, the standard of Ephraim changed from ox to unicorn, single horned. They'd gather around these standards. Now, as the tribe of Judah took on, and here are the standards of the four tribes now that are the standards on a crossbeam, Dan the eagle, Ephraim the ox, ultimately to change to the unicorn because of Baal worship, Reuben the man, and Judah the lion. Now, as the tribe of Judah began to expand in its power and David became the king, then all of a sudden, to distinguish the lion of Judah, the standard, from the tribal lion of Judah, they developed the emblem of the rampant lion, the lion who is ready to go to battle. There's the rampant lion, usually beige or at least a color other than red. And to signify the sceptership and the throne of David on this lion, a crown was added. So the standard of Judah became the rampant lion with the crown, whereas the tribe of Judah's ensign was a single couching lion or three lions and all those other signs that we put up. As the standard and Judah moved to rulership, it was a rampant lion with a crown. And then we come to the Zara people. As I've said, when they left to found Athens, and Dardanus, who's Darda, the son of Zara, to found Troy, and Brutus comes to Great Britain, they would not abandon their descendancy from Judah, which gave them the right to the lion as a symbol. They carried it with them. But to distinguish from the Judah lion, even the rampant lion of Judah with the crown, they adopted the red rampant lion to go with the scarlet thread of Zara. And the main emblems of Zara was the red rampant lion and the red hand with the cord of Zara Judah around it. Now, once you get all those heraldic emblems into your mind, then all of a sudden, you begin to be dumbfounded. If you're anything like me, as you watch the use of these emblems, you don't have four to seek to find the tribe of Reuben. It is the prominent emblem in the royal arms of Denmark and Greece. It holds an important place in the arms of Iceland, the man. It's the emblem of the province of Lapland in Sweden. As a municipal emblem in Denmark, it appears in the arms of at least 22 or 23 municipalities. Further, a man was the emblem on the banner under which King Harold of England fought and lost the Battle of Hastings. At least 17 other chiefs of Scottish clans, and in the crests of four others. His secondary emblem, a body of water represented by wavy lines, is common among Celto-Saxon people. It appears in the arms of 50 or more towns in the counties of the British Isles alone. Let's look at some of them. Lamont. Here's the heraldry. Here's the man in Odense in Denmark. Province of Zealand, Netherlands. Torshaven, Denmark. Wavy line. Man with an axe in this case. Here's the Swedish. Lapland. Menzies. Now we go to Simeon. The sword in the gate. Well, you'll find them scattered throughout Anglo-Saxon heraldry. You're going to see some others crop up, like the stag and the ox mixed with it as the tribes flow into one another. The wavy line mixed with the serpent on the pole, in this case. Wavy lines. Man again. I want to go quickly to Judah because we're running out of time. Here's a rampant lion with a sword. Simeon and Judah mixed in this heraldry. a sword here, a sword and a turret and the wavy lines of the man, the sword on a red shield, Simeon and Zara coming in, the ship, the rampant red lion. I have 3 minutes, so I've got to move fast. We come to the British Isles. Here, by the way, is Dan in an ancient stone cut with the serpent at the heels of the horse. Here is the dainties. But let me keep going. I want to come to Judah. The United States, here's the wolf in Norway. Judah, quickly. Run out of time. Always run out of time. Here's Scotland with the rampant red lion. Here's England with the three lions. I've got to find the royal arms. Why did they call the descendant of Ephraim John Bull? Think on that for a moment. The crowned kingdom of Judah. And we come to the British royal arms. Because as we've been teaching, both Judah and Ephraim come together in England. And now you have that unique heraldry of David, the harp, and the three lions, if this were able to zoom in enough, the three lions on a red field, the rampant red lion of Zara, the three lions on a red field again. Here is the rampant lion crowned of kingly Judah. Here is the unicorn of Ephraim. Here are the three lions of historic Judah. Here is the rampant red lion of Zara. Here's the harp of David. Why haven't we got a hammer and sickle or Stonehenge or something else there? Now let's look at the Scottish royal arms. Unicorns. Red rampant lion of Zara. Why, I got to quit. I think this is a fascinating study of heraldry. And again, no one piece of evidence would drive me to look at these people as possible descendants, the Celts of the lost tribes. But everywhere we turn, the link-ups between Stonehenge and the pyramid, the mystery of the founding of Troy and Athens, and come on over quickly, Ron and the musicians, because we're going to have to sign off of Channel 56 and the satellite. You folks that are on my home network, and this will be true of all the satellites, by July 18th, if all goes well. I still have a few words for you. It is that all of these facts converge like a crosshair on the same place, and you can't begin to really discover it until the archaeological and historical finds at the turn of the century and the breakaway of the United States. I'll be back.